Welcome to the HMO Success Podcast. I'm your host, Wendy Whitaker-Large, and I'm here to help you create a profitable HMO portfolio. Whether you're a brand new investor or you've been at it for a number of years, my podcast is here to help you make the most from your business, whether that is starting up, scaling, or systemizing. Please hit the subscribe button to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you've got an awe-inspiring project, an inspirational investing story, or a unique approach to HMOs, I'd love to hear from you. Well, Mr. Jim Halliburton, it's quite an honour to have you on my podcast. Thank you very much indeed for making time to be here today. I appreciate that.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to chat to you, Wendy.
Well, I don't know about that. You know so much about HMOs. I don't know if, you know, I learn a lot when I speak to you, but I think you probably learn more about how not to do it when you speak to me.
No, you have such an easy time. Look at you. We're about the same age. Yeah. Look how old I look. The proof's in the pudding.
It's great to have you on the podcast because you are known as the HMO Daddy. Rather questionable title, if I might say, as long as it's not the HMO Sugar Daddy, I suppose. Has anybody ever accused you of being the HMO Sugar Daddy? I hope not.
It's, yes, it's only afterwards that I realised the name was given to me. I can't remember his name. He said, I've got this great title for you, HMO Daddy. And then I went ahead and did this. Now, for someone who's been in the Merchant Navy and spent younger ages, I should have been aware of it. HMO Daddy would come across. And I couldn't understand why I got thousands of hits on my website. But no one's ever accused me of being a sugar daddy or even wanted me to be a sugar daddy. So pointed out.
Well, now that you're entering the, you know, your third age, Jim, maybe doors will start to open.
Possibly.
You never know. Yeah. Now, listen, I'd like to go back to the beginning. I know, I don't know if you can remember back that far, but anyway. Oh. I'm sure you can. I'd like to really understand how you got started in HMOs. What were you doing at the time? What kind of started the interest in your expansion of HMOs? But how did it start?
Well, I think it started back in 72. If I get the dates wrong, I'm terrible on dates. When I'd been brought up in a kid's home, and they kicked you out in those days at the age of 15, 16, and you had to wander the streets. So I'd got various jobs, but I'd got this ambition, burning ambition, to do a degree. I don't know why. I wanted to do a degree. I'd done reasonably well at school, much to the disgust of everyone who was there, because I was supposed to be a failure. And I thought, I ended up, as I was saying earlier, in the Merchant Navy. Had a dream job. I don't know why I gave it up. A silver service waiter, sailing around the world. But I just wanted to do a degree. So what I did was saved up, which you could while you're in the Merchant Navy, because they provided the food, accommodation. So it's an easy way to save, except I didn't spend money, which I should have done. Looking back on it, I should have enjoyed my youth. But I didn't. I saved up and went back to England and found a bedsit in Clapham, South London, with the intention of going to college to get my A-levels. And once you got your A-levels, in those days, it was amazing. You had free higher education, provided you could, what we call matriculate, had a few A-levels. You could go to university, they accepted you. And you not only did you have free education, you got a grant. So it was pretty sort of easy, rude road when you look at it. It's amazing so few people got a degree in those days when it used to be funded. Anyway, I go find a landlord, I tell him what I'm doing, and he's really impressed me. And then he, for some reason, decided to tell me his life story, which was he bought his first HMO for £3,000in Clapham, South London, for £3,000 7 years previously. And now this one is costing him £21,000. Get your head around that. Those kind of properties in Clapham now are worth £1.5 million. So he was moaning, that the price of an HMO had gone up from 3,000 to 21,000 in 7 years. And I was sitting there thinking, I thought I was pretty well paid in the Merchant Navy. I could save the money. And those days, if you earned £1,000 a year, you reckoned you were well paid. I thought, this is the business to be in. And I, one of the big regrets I had at that point was not saying to him, well, here, take my money. I forget going to university. I'll go back and have a very hedonistic lifestyle in Merchant Navy where you could eat as much as you want. You traveled as much as you want. It was a fantastic life for a young person. And you buy me a property in it. And when I get fed up sailing the high seas, I'll come back and live off the bedsit. That actually got me going. I sort of looked at that and I kept a track on the HMOs, but the value of properties in Clapham. And even though I got a qualification, I got a degree, I then became a law lecturer, I watched the price of properties, and the price of property went up faster than anything I could possibly earn. I thought, every time I kicked myself. So I wanted to get into property. By this time, I'd moved to Birmingham. I got married, and my wife didn't like the idea. So in 92, I eventually got to the point of saying, enough's enough. I am going to buy a property. So I remember it well. It was in 92, was it 92 or 91? A beautiful sunny day like today. I'd chosen what I thought was my ideal property, and I got the college, because I was working at the college, it's a college lecturer, bribed her to come and look at the property and tell me whether this would be suitable for student accommodation at the university. The first property cost me £35,000, which in 1992 was quite a bit of money. Looking back on it, it's a joke. But you didn't have the help, support, any of the information. Like, you and I provide training, loads of other people provide training, explain to people how to do this. There was none of that then. All I had was a college accommodation officer who, to put it mildly, was quite up her own arse, a very important person, and all that kind of thing. And I had to bribe her with taking her out for a lunch to see, have a look at this property, to get her to say, yeah, this would be okay or not.
And Jim, why did you have to ask her to have a look at it? What was it that you were unsure about at that point?
I hadn't got a clue about it. You've got to remember, I'd never rented property. I'd lived in a bedsit back in 72. I wasn't sure what students wanted. You don't understand. You forget. Now I've done it, I forget where people who have got not a clue start from. What do you have to do? What do you provide for your tenants? It's a completely new market to me, providing accommodation. So, yes, what do I need to know? Well, I thought I'd have to decorate the place because the wallpaper was peeling off the wall. You've got to remember, back in those days, a bedsit had to have the wallpaper peeling off the wall, threadbare carpets, usually the old Axminster type of thing, an electric light bulb, the incandescent bulb, no lampshade hanging from the lampshade. That was a typical HMO, and it let.
Like rising damp.
No, well, Rigby was actually quite good, I think. The HMO I had was worse. And the accommodation officer came along and said, yeah, that's all you need. Bob, I will send students to you when we start. Let's go and have lunch. So that's why I dragged her in. The reassurance you need when you start, especially if you're a sort of timid little soul like me, don't know what you're doing, you're unsure. After a while, you get the confidence, but the first time round, you don't realise. We forget how easy it is for us, having done it, for people who have never done it, to learn. And that's how I got started. The interesting thing is, how did I borrow the money? Because you had no training. There was no lenders out there who'd lend you to buy properties. This is before the buy-to-let happened. I'd luckily come across a book about a year previously showing you how you can raise money on your own name. What they said is, go out and get loads and loads of credit cards. You don't realize there's no limit on the number of credit cards you can have. At one time, I had 40 credit cards. Which would, if I took all the money out that you could draw out on it, £5,000, £10,000 limit, it would allow me to raise 400,000. To start with, I started with 20, went down the bank, got the credit cards, took the money out on the credit cards, put it in an Asda bag, and walked up to the solicitor. You can't do this again today. Said, here you are. I want to buy this property for £35,000. There's £35,000. That's how I got started, with the help of my college accommodation officer. So even though I say she was not very nice things about her, without her hand-holding, I would have never got started. I wouldn't have the confidence. I would have probably redecorated the whole house and put new carpets in, only to have the tenants wreck the place. Well, as it was, the tenants wrecked the place. Who cares? It was already wrecked. So that's how I got started.
So that's interesting. So you'd had this seed planted when you were living in Clapham, and it took you another 20 years before you actually did anything about it.
Was it 20 years? No, a bit longer. 90, yeah, that's 20 years. So it must have been 62. Was it 60? I'll go there. 71. 92. Yeah. 72, 90. Yeah, 20 years to get started.
So but the interesting thing is you had this kind of vague model in your mind of basically taking a property and putting multiple tenants in it. And in a way, that was kind of all you needed to know, wasn't it? At that stage, you didn't know the hows and the whys and the what ifs. You took some advice. You looked at the market and thought, actually, I'm going to rent to students. You knew students because that was who you were working with, so you knew what they were going to be like, you know, the ups and downs of working with students. You knew the kind of type of person that would be renting your house, and it was, as you say, it was getting that initial spark that maybe the university housing officer was able to offer you, or the college housing officer, to be able to just clarify a few of your questions. And it sounds like that was really what you needed to then, plus the money side of it, of course, knowledge about the money and how to raise the money, and put those two together and boom, it kind of lit the touch paper.
Correct. Yes. But I wish I'd done it much years beforehand. When we got married, we lived in near Pebble Mill, and I could have bought a property then for £8,500, which within 18 months was worth about 120,000, again, let to students. The market is opportunities that you can get into. But no, that when you think, I was only earning at that time about 12 grand a year as a senior lecturer, and I go out and buy a property for 35,000 on credit cards, it's completely insane.
So what then happened? So once you had started, how quickly did you build up the portfolio, and when did you decide to give up your job?
Ah, right. I started in 92. It seemed to work. And then I came across a bank manager who reluctantly lent me a bit of money, because I had various contacts at that time. And I was able to buy others. I bought about one a year over the next few years, up until 2004. So 92, 12 years later, isn't it? 2004. That's when I gave up my full-time job. What I did was started buying properties. And then suddenly you got the property boom in this part of the world around about 2000. I was able to remortgage. Lenders came into the market giving commercial mortgages. So I was able to buy properties as and when I could. And I was just building up a larger and larger portfolio. The college fell out with me, the college fell out with me. They didn't like the idea that I was the largest private landlord. That caused a lot of jealousy. So they, mysteriously, the college, the person who ran the college accommodation, she retired early. A new one came in, and suddenly I got no more students. She went off for some dodgy private land letting agency. So I suspect either body fluids or brown paper envelopes exchanged hands. I was cut out of providing accommodation. I was left without anyone. I just suddenly had all these empty properties. By that time, I had about eight properties and no tenants. And if you've got long stories, I can tell you sort of how I survived that period, because I suddenly had properties empty, hardly any students. apart from a few students who knew me from previous years, who phoned me up and said, Jim, we've been ripped off by all these other landlords. We've been sent there. They want deposits. They want this and that. Used to just let us come in and pay as we went. And I said, yeah. So I got a few of those. I tried unemployed, and they were a nightmare. Absolutely young, unemployed people. So I was struggling. And we had a very cold winter at that time. And I got a phone call from a Scots bloke. I could hardly understand him. And I'm from Scotland, saying that he wanted accommodation. So he came and had a look at my properties. They'd all been nicely done up, centrally heated at that time. And he walks in and he's bitter. And he told me he slept in the car. Now, I don't know if you slept in a car before, but he slept in a car at minus 10 degrees. It's when you're sleeping in a car, it gets colder inside the car than it is outside. So this poor bloke had slept, come down for a new job, unemployed for a long period of time. And he said, oh, I'm starting on the metro. And I didn't know what he was on about. I got a job. I heard this story before. I haven't got any money. I'll get paid next week. Can I pay you then? No way, mate. Go. And something just said, no, you can't go out. It's minus 12 degrees tonight. You're going to freeze to death. Stay here. I don't want it on my conscience, you freezing to death on the street when you've got an empty room like this. So I just left thinking, I'm not going to get paid. It'll be the usual rip-off con merchant that you have. We'll find, as you probably find as well, every good deed in this business does not go unpunished. If you help people out, they turn around and stab you. Whereas a housing officer said to me, if you've got a soft heart, you're going to have a hard ass. That's the way that...
Yeah, it can be absolutely brutal. You're right. Just the people that you think, you know, you're helping and you're doing a good favour to, you're absolutely right. They will turn around and stab you in the back.
Absolutely right.
So I said, learn a lot about human nature in this business, Jim.
Yes. Yeah. Well, don't let it get you down. Anyway. That was about Thursday. Anyway, about Tuesday, the following week, I get this phone call. Jimmy, didn't you want your money? And I thought, bloody hell, is this some kind of gangster phoning me up from Glasgow or somewhere like, Jimmy, do you want your money? And then I suddenly remembered, oh, that was that Scotsman I moved in. He said, I've got your money. Where, don't you want it? I said, yeah, sure, I'll be straight round. Picked up the rent. He was the foreman for the site that brought in all the construction workers to build the metro, which is a railway line we've got down here. So they call it a metro, but it's like a smaller railway line. And my properties were full, over full, because all these construction workers, he had recommended them to me. They were paid obscene amount of money, these lads. I remember as a lecturer looking at it, thinking, this lad just drives a digger and he's earning five times as much as I do. It's quite enormous, the money they made doing this. It wasn't permanent work. Well, I had. So I carried on doing that. And I would have stayed lecturing because I love lecturing. I love doing property, but teaching is a passion for me. That's why I still try and teach now and get involved. You probably gather. I just love pontificating.
You do. And I think actually the other thing that you enjoy is almost helping people do what you were doing in 1992, which was struggling, finding their way, not knowing who to turn to, and you're that person that they can turn to and ask those questions, and you'll give them the practical answers. You're not just somebody who theorizes about it. You know the practical day-to-day reality of running one HMO or a big portfolio of HMOs, and you know, I think that's why people come to you, Jim.
Yeah. I'm surprised how few do want to ask. Maybe they feel there's a barrier between me and I want help. Maybe I give that aura, but no, I'm always happy to give a fellow landlord 5 minutes of my time if they've got issues or problems. Just, and I love talking about it. I go to shows and events, run into other landlords and just talk about the business. I enjoy that. But you don't get it with your tenants. You can't talk to them. Your staff are not particularly interested in it. I just love the job. I used to love lecturing and I still enjoy teaching, but it takes a lot of effort. It's easier to make money in property and then talking about it is quite hard work, running courses and the rest. And it's an organisation which, since COVID, I've laid down, but I'm still happy to do consultancy, or I do mentorship where people come and work in my business to learn how to be a landlord. It's sort of a bit like, what's the term for it?
An apprenticeship.
Internship. Yeah, not apprenticeship. Yeah, just apprenticeship, I suppose, or internship.
Internship.
Learn about the business.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm happy to help. People say you're cutting your own throat, but I think the market's so enormous out there, it doesn't make any difference. It's a bit like telling politicians and the council how to sort out the housing problem. I could sort it out overnight, but the problem is that I would destroy all our HMO business, because HMO is based on shortage. So if you could solve the housing problem, why would you want HMOs?
Well, that is a very interesting point, Jim, because actually one of my questions, because of your knowledge, your experience, and obviously tying that together with your background in law, one of my questions is going to be, and I'm going to ask this to you now, what change do you think would make the biggest impact in the HMO sector?
Right. Appreciate. Most people, I don't know if you have the same experience, most people take an HMO because they can't afford a flat. Most of them go, this will do until I get myself a flat or a house. Or the one I hate the worst is until my wife takes me back. that is annoying. But yeah, most people don't look upon an HMO as for life. So the question was, what would have the biggest impact on HMOs?
Yeah.
Yeah, just abolish planning. Get rid of planning, take away the green belt, bang, we wouldn't have a problem at all. The planning system is what has a stranglehold on development. Greenbelt, again, people don't realise. They say, oh, there's a shortage of land. That's not. 2.5% of this country is built on. 2.5%. That means 97.5% is not built on. There's plenty of land in this country. There's more land given over to golf courses. 3.5% of our green and beautiful land is golf courses, as opposed to commercial. And then you've got, even if you want to protect greenbelt, you've got brownfield sites. I've tried to turn brownfield sites, that's commercial buildings, into residential. And the planners stop you doing so. They're going, whatever the reasons. A lot of the time, they seem to think that commerce would come back and need this building. Well, they won't. This building is out of use. There's no way that anyone would want this. So it's the planning system that's causing the problem. But then if you take away planning, then my business would just be destroyed, because they'd be able to build as many flats and houses as you want. And very few people would want the kind of accommodation I have. HMOs are based on shortage. And also you'd cause the price of property to collapse. So there's the answer, very simple. And that's what the government have been trying to do. Like, they brought in prior notification, we turn commercial into resi, and now they're backtracked.
So we know, you're absolutely right, that planning is a massive hindrance to producing new accommodation, whether that's HMOs or single properties or large properties or whatever it is, you know, just utilising some of the empty properties, utilising commercial property. It's sitting there, a lot of it's on the high street, and it just can't be used for residential, even though we're in an absolute housing crisis. What are your thoughts about legislation? So you've got the planning side of it, which is, you know, one whole big area, but what do you think about the legislative side of it?
If you talk about the regulation on HMOs and properties, then it's a complete waste of time. If you look, they've brought in all this massive legislation to control HMOs, started with GAS, I think that's probably one of the earliest ones, housing standards, and all the rest of it. None of it stands up to any rational assessment. To make a law that says you have to do something, you have to show there's a benefit from this. So if you just take fire for a start, HMO's got to have fire doors, fire alarms. That's a very important thing that you insist on having. How many people die in HMOs due to fire? Very few. It's a handful, if that. And what we do prevent people dying? And the answer is very little. It has little effect. Now, you compare, say, 50 people dying a year through fires in HMOs with 140,000 people dying through smoking, 3,000 people dying in car accidents. I can't remember how many in life crime, domestic violence, 100 women, mostly women, die every year. The figures don't add up. 50 deaths would not, there'll still be deaths in HMOs through fire because of the nature of fireworks. None of it makes any sense. It has not got, on a cost basis, has any value. Licensing, I still can't understand licensing, what the value is of that. The only slight pleasure I get out of it is, one, it puts people off being HMO landlords or landlords, bureaucratizes the whole thing, and it costs the council more to administer licensing than they charge. People say, I've had to pay £1,000 for my license. Here, sunshine, do you realise it costs the council £2,000 in manpower and time to issue that licence? You can't believe how inefficient local authorities are. It just sounds good, all these things, but they don't actually have any value. The money would be far better off put into preventing people dying from, smoking, obesity, all the other problems that we have, even sepsis, which is down to dirty hospitals, could be prevented. And I say, over 140,000 people die through catching diseases in hospitals. A lot could be reduced. I have no value. And then you've got Osborne taking away Section 24, which is, reduces the tax relief on mortgages, taking away the 10% wear and tear allowance, abolishing admin fees. And all these other things have just hit the private rented sector.
And of course, I think you're right that what we're seeing is those just act as barriers to entry for new investors, which is good for those of us who are, as you say, we're already established. We've already got our rooms. We've got our HMOs. We can sort of sit pretty because we can think, well, you know, we navigate the system. We understand the system and we understand what the costs are to our business. You know, we've figured that one out. And it's not like a new learning curve either. But the problem is that the tenants are paying for the fact that there isn't enough competition out there. And tenants are paying in their rent and in their living costs, those extra costs. So ultimately, it's the tenant who pays. And, I don't think that this is ever recognised by the government. I don't think they seem to acknowledge that the domino falls somewhere, and it's not going to fall on the landlord because landlords have figured out a way to pass those costs on. And because the government have also restricted the market to such an extent, there isn't even the competition to be able to, for tenants to say, well, I'm not going to go there because it's another £20 a week. I'll go over here because it's just as good. Well, there isn't the choice anymore either. There just is not the availability.
You're absolutely right. And you forget the other point that 2.5% of private landlords have left the market in the last 24 months. The market is decreasing. And landlords, if they're forced to sell up because they can't make money anymore, I think you're telling me that a lot of your HMO landlords are selling up. They sell up into a rising market and go off a nice pile of cash after paying the capital gains tax, etc., and live happily ever after without all the hassle that we have in being a landlord. So it's a win-win. Landlords going, so the market is on. I believe the market is in decline.
There was a survey done actually last year that said that 500,000 HMOs had been taken out of the market in the last 2 years. 500,000 HMOs have left the market effectively. Mm. Either they've been turned into flats, I think some of them turned into serviced accommodation. Some of them would have been turned back into family homes. But how many rooms is that? Even if they've just got, you know, 5 rooms, that's 2.5 million rooms that have left the market. Well, that would be why we're at basically 100% occupancy at the moment. And, you know, we just cannot fill our, we can't sort of produce rooms quickly enough. As soon as we have a new HMO, boom, it's filled again, which is crazy. And actually, it's the first time in my whole time of doing HMOs I've seen it this competitive and seen the demand to be so high.
Yes. Well done, Wendy. You have such a charmed life. I still got boys.
Well,
I'm still struggling to fill them. But I've always had voids. I think it's just the nature of the business. I used to moan about it years ago. But even when I was opening up back in 2004, I suddenly decided to expand and bought 50 HMOs in a year. Well, created 50 properties in 1 year. That's the power of focus. And if you set yourself targets, you can do things. Not a great idea, a bit like my going back to me wanting to do a degree. I could be better off staying in property if I'd stayed in property or in the Merchant Navy. And then I suddenly decided, yeah, I think I'll have a lot of properties, because I retired in 2004 and went in more into property and decided to make it full time. So that created an enormous nightmare of administration, of dealing with staff. And that in itself is not particularly good. You've always got this balance of do it yourself and be bored by the mundane, repetitive job of running HMOs, or you employ staff and have the hassle of dealing with staff. It is a conundrum. I'm not sure which I'd prefer.
Well, I think that, you know, what the ideal is to have a system, a business that works for you. So you don't work. You might work on the business, but you don't work in the business. I think the reality is with HMOs, even if you have a great team and you have really good systems and you've really got good processes, you can't fully get away from it. Why is that? Well, I think because at the heart of it, the HMO business requires such a lot of weaving of housing law, practice, common sense, financial awareness, people awareness. To have all those skills, it's often the entrepreneur or the business owner who has, without realizing it, got those skills, maybe to a greater or lesser degree. And the staff require that person to lead them because they do not have all those skills. And I think what I find with my staff is they're not sometimes prepared to take the risks that I would take. You know, I would say to some tenants, no, we're not doing that. No, you can't have that. No, that is not possible. No, 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 no. Because what I found with tenants is there's a small proportion of them that if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile, and they want a mile, and you have to keep pushing back. Whereas I think our staff team, and I don't know whether you find this sometimes, Jim, they're not sometimes prepared to say no to tenants. They're scared. They're scared of what the tenants will think, what the tenants will do, who the tenants will report this to, in that we're going to get into trouble, or that the council is going to get involved, or we're going to get an improvement notice, or we're going to be taken to court, or you know, all these what ifs. And most of them are just not going to happen. In fact, we have never had legal action that has been instigated from a tenant against us. In fact, we've never actually had any legal action taken against us from anybody. It's us taking the legal action. We're the ones to instigate the legal action, you know, usually eviction. So this fear, I'm not quite sure where it comes from, but it's this inability sometimes to take a decision and weigh up all the different factors. And I think that's where, as an HMO landlord, whether you've got just a handful of HMOs or a big portfolio, you do find yourself getting drawn into that kind of decision-making process. Do you find that as well? Is that what happens with you?
I can feel your pain, Wendy. You can always tell someone who's doing it because they lose the rag. They're bitter, they're twisted. You can feel that going through. And this is how things, is it different? People have different experiences. I must be the biggest tart going. My staff are tougher on my tenants than I am. I'm always saying, they are customers. The answer is yes. Now, what's the question? we're complete reversal. Yet I'm the one who's being easy, give the tenants what they want. My staff go, no, you can't do that. You're being soft. They'll walk all over you. And yes, I've been sued numerous times by my tenants. So you've had a completely different experience. But that's one of the things we have. We have got to be careful about one size fits all. Everyone has the same idea, the same problems. Nothing particularly works, and everything works in HMOs. So I go back to, I bought properties in the most daftest of places, irrationally looking back on it, completely insane, and they've always let. I'm worried in the early days when I buy properties whether they would let. So, yes, I don't find my staff are easy. They're tough on my tenants, most of them, if they're motivated to do the job. The problem is finding staff who will do the job. And I'm much luckier, far luckier now than I was in the early days, because I had some absolute nightmares of staff who just almost used the business as their own personal fiefdom and ran it like their own, and the fiddling that went on and the rest of it. And now things are much, much, much better from that point of view. But it's still not perfect. It never is. I could, not now, but I'm a year or two ago, I could have walked away from the business for 6 months and the business would have carried on. My role is more developing, taking on more properties. No one seems to be able to be able to decide this would be a good property to have, go about doing the development and carrying it through. But the day-to-day job of letting the properties, chasing up the tenants, dealing with maintenance, because it's a very simple business being an HMO landlord. You've got to fill your properties, make sure the little darlings pay, and then maintain the property. And then, fourth thing is the admin that goes with it, keeping the records for the inland revenue and all that rubbish. But you've got to do it. It's quite heavy admin-based. It's amazing how much time can be involved in that. Just dealing with utilities is an absolute nightmare.
Let's talk about that, because I know that you've got some kind of interesting thoughts and approaches when it comes to energy. You know, this is one of the things that I'm obviously hearing a lot. I'm sure you are too. Lots of landlords complaining that they're thinking of selling up their HMO. One of our landlords is thinking of selling because of the energy costs. So what are your insider tips and tricks to deal with this, Jim?
It's not particularly insider tricks or the rest of it. That the cheapest and easiest way to save money on utilities is a shop around. It's like insurance. You go to landlords and they moan about the utility bill. I say, well, do you shop around? Oh, no, I'm with X company. I won't mention them. Well, have you tried to see if you can buy it cheaper? I appreciate now we can't swap around, but you can save a lot of money by changing. Same with insurance. Whenever I take on a rent to buy or rent to rent, the owner goes, oh, I'll carry on paying the insurance. And I take it off them because I can usually save, what's that? I'm trying to do the math. I can, when I get insurance, it's 20% of what they're paying. So that's what, an 80% saving. They pay five times as much as I can get the insurance. And they think they've got a good deal and they've got a great broker and all the rest of it. Utilities, first thing, shop around for the cheapest supplier. Second is the management of the property itself. If you give unlimited gas and electricity, some tenants will respect that. And you'll have tenants, not every tenant puts the central heating on full blast, open the windows full wide, and lets all the heat out. It doesn't always happen. But if you've got that problem, then you've got to control it. So the way around this is I put in prepay meters into the property. So the tenant has to pay for the electric they use in their own room. That, on average, halves the cost of electricity to the property, because the tenant will switch everything off because they're now paying and they are conscious of that. So before, tenants would leave everything switched on, they now switch it off. So you half your electric bill, and that was just happy with that. You also sell the electricity to the tenants. So if you use the meters, they've got to pay you for the electric that they use on their meters. I didn't worry too much about that. I was just happy that they weren't abusing it. And initially, when I installed it, I'd often give away the electric cards like confetti. because they were managing it. Now we've got much more sophisticated menu cards. We can't give the cards away because I moved over to a system where it's online. If they pay for the electric, they have to do it online or credit card. So I don't receive them. I'm not in the position to hand out free cards. So most of the cost of electricity is now covered by the prepay meters. Yes, you've got the communal areas, but it adds up to nothing. People say, well, they'd use the kitchen or they sit in the lounge. They don't. Lounges and kitchens in my HMOs hardly ever get used. They're just ornaments that the housing standards demand I provide. And it just annoys me because you've got a lounge and you walk in there, it's completely trashed, or you've got some dosser living in there. What is the point of having a lounge? Because some middle class bloody housing bureaucrats decide that you have to provide lounges if your rooms are not of a certain size. Complete waste of time. And it shows how out of touch they are. Kitchens, my HMO tenants don't cook. You very rarely get HMO tenants cook. If you do, they're always from China, Africa, or Eastern Europeans cook. But British, I don't know, they can cook. I think cooking is something that you see on TV now. Certainly, they don't cook. I never quite worked out what they eat. I suspect they get it out of a round metal can. It's called beer, and they live on that from the observations that I can work out. But they don't. There's very rarely you get any cooking on the property. So you get around the electric by that. The heating, just put electric heaters in the property. There is no obligation on a landlord to provide central heating. All they have to do is provide a fixed form of heating. So you buy electric panel heater. I've stopped using panel heaters now. We put fan heaters in because the fire risk. If you put a panel heater in, it's on bed level and some idiot will stick bedding over it or whatever and set fire to the place. So we put fan heaters on the wall, and that all comes off the electric. So they're paying for everything. So you can, if you wanted to, in other words, reduce your utility gas electricity bills to zero. I haven't gone as far as that. I still provide central heating to my tenants because I like my tenants. I want them to be warm. I don't want them to be sitting there freezing away in a freezing house. Even though I'm not appreciated for it, I just provide the central heating. And currently, I can afford to do that because luckily I'm on a contract. So the massive increase in utility costs hasn't affected me to any great extent because my contracts are still running. And I suspect the cost of gas and electricity will come back down again, probably not to where they were before, but they will certainly be lower than the horrendous is the bills where I have to pay for the gas and electricity, where they've gone up, have gone up 5 times. So in other words, a unit of electricity which used to cost me 15p is now 75p. So that is enormous cost.
But and luckily, of course, it's the standing charge as well, which people don't realise. It's not just the kilowatt hour charges, it's standing charges have massively increased.
Absolutely true, Wendy, that you've got to take into account that one. So there's a few of those which I'm looking at and trying to sort out, but most of it I'm okay so far, and I'll see what happens as it pans out. But we may go on for prepay meters. I do them, virtually all my properties got prepay meters. That holds electricity cost down, and I get most of the cost back, so it's no cost to me. But you explain that to HMO landlords, say, oh, you can't do that and all the rest of it. You can. You probably have the same problem as I do. If you say, look, if you don't find the cost of utilities too much, make them zero. And they won't accept that advice.
I think the challenge is the market. It's more that the tenants aren't used to that. The tenants are used to being offered, particularly in the professional marketplace, all-inclusive rents. That's become the norm, all-inclusive rents. And many landlords, I think, are very cautious about raising the rents or asking for more payment for utilities, even though some of them will have a fair use clause in the contract. Now, I know that's about usage, not about cost, but nevertheless, you could alter your fair use clause in your contract as well. I think there are things that landlords can do. I think, as you've said, you know, we're not powerless. But I think fear grips a lot of people to take on board new and different ways of doing it. They think their market is the only market that's there. They don't think people will pay for rooms that are not all inclusive. But actually, if you are adjusting the rent so that your tenants are paying some of their rent that they would have paid to you, instead, they're keeping it because you're then making accommodation from the fact that you're not doing all inclusive. Many of them are very grateful for that. Many of them are pleased to pay slightly lower rent and to be responsible for their own usage of their electricity. We've got it in one of our properties in Stoke. And what we found is that the people who rent that house are people who've often come into the country and don't have a lot of money. They're happy to pay for individual metering because it means that the rent overall is much lower for them. So, you know, I think there is this sort of fear that we've kind of got this model in our minds. This is what we've always done, and this is what we should always do. And when you advertise your rooms on Spare Room, you're now going to have to say it's not all inclusive, and that suddenly you're not going to rent your rooms out. Well, I would argue and say that's actually not the case. In many cases, you'll actually probably get more demand for those rooms. So Jim, obviously energy is not something that keeps you up at night. You don't worry about that now. But what does worry you? Is there anything that does worry you about your HMOs?
Can I just go back on the energy bit? You've brought up a fantastic point. It's our brains. We get locked in. We don't think it's going to work. We assume you get a fixed idea and it doesn't happen. Tell you what, go on, as I've done, where properties haven't been metered, I go into them and I say, look, I'm going to have to put your rent up by 20 quid a week, or we fit a meter and your rent stays where it is. I have never, ever had a tenant say, get lost, Jim, you put rent up by 20 quid. They all say, oh, fit a meter. So getting around that issue is very simple. If you, as a landlord, think that, just go and talk to your tenant. They're the ones who will tell you, do you want me to put your rent up, or do you want me to keep the rent as it is and you pay for your own electricity? You can even say, I'll give you £5 a week. That's all you should be using in your room, inclusive. I wouldn't, because it causes too much admin. So you can get around that. And last point I'm going to make is I've wrote a book on prepay meters. I'm trying to do my bit to save the planet. And if you want it, you can have a copy free. So I've written a book on how to fit HMO landlords about prepay meters, how to fit them, all the problems you have and the objections you can deal with on that. And you can have a download free from HMO Daddy. Just go on the website and say HMO Daddy and you'll get my website. Send me an email and I'll give you a download free. Or if you want a hard copy of the book, I can't remember what it is. It's probably about £4.
That's great, Jim. What I'll do is I'll put those in the podcast notes. I'll get the links from you and I'll put all of this in the podcast notes. So anyone who's listening who'd like a copy of Jim's book, absolutely free, it'll all be in the podcast notes so that you can click on the link and get that download straight away, which is fabulous. Thank you.
So what keeps me awake about HMOs? Nothing. it doesn't keep me awake. I do feel the market is, as I said earlier, the government have screwed the market. Private landlords are on the way out. If you go back to the Second World War, pre-Second World War, 90% of landlords, 90% of properties were owned by private landlords. 90% of people, should I say, lived with private landlords. So pre-1939, most people were housed by private landlords. The Labour Party got in after the Second World War, and by 1980, the number of private landlords had dropped to 8%. It then went up to 20%, and it's now coming back down, and it's going to continue down. The Conservative government, for various reasons, nothing to do with care for the tenants or anything else like that, but just trying to claim political advantage to distinguish themselves from the Labour Party, to say they're on the side of the tenants, are destroying private landlords. So unfortunately, I don't think I'm going to have a business as an HMO landlord to give to my children's children and children. I will not be able to build a dynasty up on that. What I need to do is get out of the HMO market. And this is terrible for HMO daddy to say, but the way I would not stay in the HMO market, move into single lets, move into commercial or other types of property assets.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I was going to ask you, this is my last question, Jim, is, and it's relevant being a last question, is what is your exit strategy?
It's called a wooden box, if I can afford it. I'm no exit strategy. There is no point being an exit. Why would you want to exit something that's going up and up and up? We touched on it a bit earlier. You can I don't have to work in my business. A couple of things changed a couple of years ago, but up until a couple of years ago, I could walk away from my business and leave it to be run. I didn't have to be involved personally. My personal involvement is buying more properties and trying to improve the performance of what I'm doing. I've got staff now. I'm quite happy to leave to run the business, so I don't need to exit. And if I live for another 20 years, my portfolio will, on average, double every 20 years. So depends how long. So why would I want to sell it if I don't need to work in it? Yes, you get the odd problem and such, but most of it is systemized. You've got the same. You're much more systemized and clever than I am and all that side of thing. You must have systems for everything, and your systems will work far better than mine, but my very inefficient systems still perform. So there is no want to exit. If I did exit, it would be sell off. My children, they're welcome to the business, but I'm not sure that they'd want it. And I don't think it's the property business makes money and I enjoy it, but I don't think it has the academic charge, the demand. It's a very simple business. You just have to find tenants. What's that make you? Someone who does a little bit of advertising, marketing, it's not high skilled. You're not going to end world hunger at that kind of level, something clever. You make sure the people pay. That's just a little bit of personality and forcefulness, a bit of maintenance. That's a bit of DIY. It's not a complex business to run this business. So if you want a bit more fulfillment in life, running HMOs, I just say you're nothing more than a chambermaid. You shouldn't be calling them chambermaids now. I'm not sure what the literally term for it is now. But that's
housekeeper, all you do. I suspect.
Housekeeper, yeah. But housekeeper is a bit more cleverer. That's what you do. And you're just cleaning up after people every time they leave, polishing up the rooms, making sure they let them and pay the money. So I've no intention of exiting the market unless someone comes along and offers me some obscene amount of money, and I might be tempted, mainly because it gets rid of the hassle and responsibility, which is brewing away. I feel I've got a target on my back. I don't lose too much sleep about this, but I do have systems in place to make sure I've got checklists and Christ knows what else to make sure properties are checked and all the rest of it, because the HMO market is just becoming like motorists, except with motorists, there's a justification for it because so many people get killed and injured on the roads every day. We're now, as HMO landlords, being fined, penalised by these HMO housing officer thugs, Gestapo, for no benefit. It's just destroying the market. It makes no sense to me. And it's done because politicians want to get re-elected. They like to pontificate away, saying we are cracking down on rogue landlords. Even the housing, our landlord association says more should be done about bad landlords. Sod it. The bad landlords are the social landlords. And yet everyone keeps very quiet about that. And yet billions have been poured into the social sector and wasted. Don't get me on that one. Well,
well, that is a whole other topic, which, yes, at some point does require examination. Jim, what I love about you is you're completely resilient as a rebel. You never give up rebelling. You never give up stating things as they are and making things plain to people. And, you know, I think in this world where HMOs can, to the new investor, seem incredibly complicated with all the rules and regulations, you simplify it. You make it so that people simply can understand that you're taking a property, you're splitting it up into various different units, which requires very little work very often, and you're making it a house where individuals come together and live, and in good ones they form a bit of a community and they might develop friendships and they get on and they work together and they decide who puts the bins out and they, you know, they keep the kitchen tidy. And in others it doesn't quite work as well as that. You have to get a bit more involved. Yeah, maintenance, collecting rent, these are the key activities that you will do as an HMO landlord. And the more that you can systemize that and have a team who does that for you, in my view, the better, because then it gives you time to, as you say, do the important part, which is finding the new deals, finding the properties and finding the money. So you can carry on growing your portfolio. The challenge, I think, for anybody in property right now is the ongoing and increasing levels of legislation and the increasing levels of invasiveness from the state to put their sticky fingers into our businesses, which we've spent time, sweat and tears and, you know, often blood and toil as well to make happen. For the benefit actually of our local communities as well as for our tenants. But currently that's not being recognised. But time will tell. Very often you see, you look back at markets and think, you know, they swung from left to right. And, you know, when the government suddenly realises that actually they've caused the resultant trauma for tenants in terms of rental increase and nowhere, no choice and nowhere to rent, maybe one day they'll recognize that it was down to them. You don't think so, though. You have very little faith to think that's ever going to happen.
Look at the history. With the, I said 90% of people lived before the war in private rented sector. The Labour government destroyed it. They knew they were destroying the private rented sector because political reigns. And that's what happens. The government don't. I don't want to get too political, but the government will do things that destroy the country because they want to be re-elected. And until people get themselves educated and understand what's going wrong, and when the politicians come round to the doorstep and say, what are you picking on private landlords for? Nothing's going to happen. And that's not going to happen either. No one's going to sit around and say, why are you picking on private landlords? They're worried about oil or saving the whale and other things like that, which, you know, that's another interesting debate to be had. It's not. People, you've got democracy requires to be re-elected because you've got a population that understands what the issues are. You're not going to get anywhere. And unfortunately, no one loves the landlord. So just... you need to, unfortunately, accept it. It's not going to go downhill overnight. I mean, there's still probably opportunities to be had, but we've had the best part of this business. Sorry to end on a pessimistic note, but I think the business has peaked. But there's still opportunity, and there's still, if I was to start again, I can't think of anything better than doing property. You're providing worthwhile accommodation at a fraction of the cost of the social sector. And most landlords and most tenants are wonderful. When you go and see them and talk to them, it's a pleasure to deal with them.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't regret a minute of investing in HMOs, despite all the heartache and the pain and the time and the fact that you don't quite know what the outcome is going to be of a situation or a conversation. But actually, I think it's an incredible journey, and I think that HMOs are an amazing type of accommodation. And I hope that maybe, Jim, as you and I, you know, shuffle off this mortal coil eventually, long time yet. You know, there will be an evolution. I hope there is an evolution in the private rental sector. Perhaps I have a bit more hope than you do, but I think it can happen. I think there's new ideas coming forth, and I think there are new ways of creating accommodation for people in the future, because while ever we need it, while ever there is a demand for it, it will have to be supplied. And I sincerely hope that it is the PRS that supplies it, because I think that is by far the best route to creating the best quality, the best price. You know, that's where I'd like it to be. And Jim, you know, don't feel unloved. We all love you. You've made a massive contribution to this sector. Probably one of the people in the UK who's actually made the biggest contribution to HMOs overall. The number of people you've worked with, spoken to, taught, mentored, and also housed. You know, you've done a really incredible thing over the years that you've been investing, and long may it continue.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Wendy.
And you, Jim.
Talking about the business. Thank
Wonderful. You.
You
take care. Thanks ever so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the HMO Success Podcast. If you'd like to know more about how you can create a profitable HMO business, please visit our website, hmosuccess.co.uk, to find out more. We have plenty of free tools and information for you there, and also on our Facebook group, The Ultimate HMO Success System. We look forward to connecting with you very soon. Thanks for listening.